I think it's time I gave these people a rest. Don't you?
I was just asking,
yeah, that's his pretentious Latin version of Gaten.
Well,
De Specius Art Villa, he calls himself on the title page.
Wonderful, thank you very much.
Good, thank you.
Testing, testing, testing. Seminar, Friday, 6th of June, Professor Gollum, class in Australian historiography.
I think it's fairly usual at the beginning of papers and at the end of books to apologise for what you are about to do or what you have done. I'm afraid that the talk I'm going to give will be rather rougher than I had intended because, and much less complete. Perhaps we better wait a few more minutes, should we? Can you roll it back and start? Well, I said in the paper that I circulated that I was going to focus this talk on Connell and Irving's new book, Class Structure in Australian Society, and that's what I am going to do. But before doing that, I want to make a very quick run over some aspects of what I think is related to this book, of what's happened in Australian history over the last 30 years. Or mainly over the last 20 years. I think it's true to say, and there are enough people here to back me up who will remember, I think it's true to say that 30 years ago it was a truism in academic circles that the only thing that historians, or particularly young historians, were interested in was the labour movement and the working class. It was a truism, but it wasn't true. Australian history at that time was, the writing of Australian history at that time was very limited indeed. Most of what had been written was about discovery, the discovery of Australia by Europe and the extension of European settlement into the continent. A little about the establishment of British political institutions and so on. There was, of course, Hancock's brilliant essay of interpretation. There was Shand's attempt at an economic interpretation of Australian history. And there were other things. But the reason for the currency of the comment, I think, about the primacy of working class or labour movement history was the position occupied by the work of Brian Fitzpatrick. His two volumes were certainly the most substantial achievement up to that time of historical writing about Australia from the inside. Not simply as an offshoot of Britain or as a part of the empire, but a society worthy of study in its own right. Of course, it was a very great achievement by one person, writing from the primary sources without the support of much in the way of monographs, nothing of research assistance, and no academic job to sustain his hunger and his thirst, which we all know was considerable. Nor, of course, did he have the bulletproof desk from behind which many of us operate. I won't go on. I think the story of Brian Fitzpatrick's life and achievements has been very well covered by Don Watson in his biography. I merely wish to emphasize that in 1950, Brian Fitzpatrick filled a good deal of the sky, so far as historians were concerned. Since then, since 1950, there have been two major individual enterprises in Australian historiography, those of Manning Clark and of Noel Butlin. Of course, I mean major enterprises of general interpretation from a specific theoretical position. Of course, there have been many important books and articles, but I think the work of Manning and Noel Butlin of major importance because of their attempt at general interpretation. However, in case anyone thinks that I'm going to appraise the work of either of these people here and now, I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint you, because my task is to talk about class in Australian historiography, and in neither case is that their central concern, although in both cases it is relevant to their work. Brian Fitzpatrick had no doubt that class was central to his interpretation. His books are written in terms of class conflict and of the role of imperialism. He was a Marxist of a kind and was morally identified with the labour movement. Many of you will know the famous statement of his own credo. I take the view that the effort of the organised working class has been, perhaps could not but have been, beyond its class ends, an effort to achieve social justice, whereas the possessing classes that have opposed labour have not, according to my reading, attempted to reform society or to redistribute wealth in the interest of social justice. Not that I blame them. My belief is simply that the labour effort, impelled by motives similar in kind to those of the owning classes, happens to coincide with an effort towards social justice, whereas the effort against labour, the effort to retain privilege, has been in opposition to the advancement of society. At least, that is how history has worked out during the last 50 years. I'm placing emphasis on Fitzpatrick for two reasons. Firstly, because he is a very significant Australian historian, in anybody's language. And secondly, because Connell and Irving assert that their book takes off from where Fitzpatrick left off. They recognise, at least implicitly, as their footnotes would indicate, that much has happened since Fitzpatrick was writing, they look on it with a rather jaundiced eye. Now, I think the big thing which has happened, so far as class in historiography is concerned, was the establishment of labour history as an area of study. The term itself was never used by Brian Fitzpatrick about himself. It began to be used about 20 years ago, and having been conceptualised, one of the consequences was the establishment of the society of that name, the Society for the Study of Labour History, which of course followed within a year or so of the establishment of the British Society and was directly influenced by that event. I want to say a few things about the idea of labour history itself and the organisation and effort which flowed from it. There are a few seats up here. The concept of labour history was the definition of an area of historical phenomena rather than the description of any theoretical approach to history. The area was working people and the labour movement and its institutions. Why it happened at that time, I think, was that most Marxists and quasi-Marxist historians who'd been caught in the dogmatism and schematism emanating from Stalin's Russia were aware by 1960 that the idea of inevitable progress towards a socialist revolution as a result of the increasing unity and socialist consciousness of the working class was not consistent with the historical or contemporary evidence, certainly in the advanced capitalist countries. So generally they decided that they had to look and think again. Many of those who identified with or were simply interested in the working class and or the labour movement, and who held very different ideological preconceptions from those of the Marxists, shared the area of interest, and the things that divided them appeared at that time to be less important than the things that united them. Thus, labour history provided a focus, but was and is eclectic in the theoretical approaches of its practitioners. If you doubt the truth of this observation, I suggest that you read through the 20 years of the journal Labour History, or the Australian version, or the British Journal, and I think that will be eminently confirmed. I think this enterprise of labour history over the last 20 years has enormously enriched Australian historical writing. I agree with John Merritt's recent remark that labour history is now the most important Australian historical journal. John may have had his tongue in his cheek when he made the remark, but I don't think he had it very far in his cheek. It, of course, has been fed from the work of thesis writers, which would otherwise not have reached any sort of a public, from work generated by the journal itself and from many other sources. And, of course, I'm not saying that the journal Labour History covers the whole sky of labour history. However, it is most important to recognise that labour history is not... It's also important to recognise that labour history has not been static. It has responded in greater or lesser degree to other impulses which have developed independently of it or sometimes in association with it. The position of women in history and society, the role of racism and so on, being just the most notable of these. The beginning to arrive area of intellectual history again has in some ways penetrated the thinking about labour history. Before proceeding to my next point, I want to emphasise that in my opinion labour history has been one of the most creative enterprises which has occurred in Australian historiography over the last 20 years. Perhaps it's not produced notable great individual works, but a great deal has been done of very high quality in that area. Labour history as a means of understanding the role of the working class has always, of course, been criticised from the political right or patronised by the pedants who think that history should be about something more important than working people. However, the criticism from the left began in England, or in English-speaking discourse, a little more than a decade ago. And I think it can conveniently be dated from Gareth Stedman's Jones article in the New Left Review, The Poverty of Empiricism, in which he coined the famous phrase that was seized on in Australian historical writing by Humphrey McQueen, who compensates for the inadequacies of his historical method by his enormous capacity to pick up a brilliant phrase. the famous phrase, the safe pastures of labour history. I myself was startled into an awareness of the fact that I was browsing in a safe pasture when I came across one of a critic who called me or associated me with an association that I was very glad to have, actually, with Brian Fitzpatrick, Ian Turner, and extraordinarily Geoffrey Searle, as the various members of an incubus that was threatening, was hanging over the Australian historical air. Well, obviously it's not possible here to trace the course of the debate, which has gone on furiously ever since, even if I were able to. However, a few things about it. The debate has occurred at various levels. At the level of theory, where it's been informed and, I think, often confused by the rediscovery of Lukács and Gramsci, by the rise and decline, I think, of Althusser, and by, of course, the extensive and conflicting re-evaluations of Marx and Engels. Not unrelated to this are the anarchist, Trotskyist, Maoist critiques of revolutionary parties in power. The second level, I think, is that of the practice of history, which itself has been influenced by and has influenced the theoretical debate. I think the seminal event in the practice of history, written in the English language at any rate, was the publication in 1964 of Edward Thompson's The Making of the Working Class. Or was it 1963? 64, I think. Its importance can be judged from the fact that it has been at the centre of debate ever since and is still very much there. But its seminal character rests on two main things. The fact that it escaped from the rigid and circumscribed definitions of class, which had bound Marxists for a generation, and the fact that he brought a great range of new kinds of evidence, mainly ideological and literary, to his examination of the process of class formation. I return to Australia, and I will be returning to Edward Thompson also. I return to Australia. The left criticism of labour history, and particularly its practitioners, may be reduced to a few central propositions. I think the most important are that generally it has not been written as a part of a socialist dialogue. Secondly, that concentration on the working class has concealed the fact that the working class exists in relation to a ruling class. And thirdly, that it has not explored the nature of cultural hegemony in the Australian situation. In addition, the question is often asked, why has no one done an Australian Thompson? Well, there's a short answer to that. Thompsons are pretty hard to find. Of course, there is a longer answer. But I think at this stage, it's not unfair to ask, has Australia found a two-headed Thompson in Connell and Irving? They don't claim that for themselves, of course. And their enterprise is indeed of a very different kind. But in their introductory theoretical chapter, they rely heavily on Thompson's famous definition of class, to which, again, I will return in a moment. But first of all, Connell and Irving place themselves firmly within the context of socialist debate. They do so in the introduction, but I think it is said better by Connell in his Ruling Class, Ruling Culture, where he has this to say. Socialists of the 19th century, though disagreeing in every conceivable way about how it should happen, were reasonably agreed that the collapse of capitalism